A lot of things in the Book of Mormon are hard to explain. We know on the thesis that Joseph Smith wrote the Book of Mormon. Indeed, the existence of the Book of Mormon is quite impossible on that ground. The fact that it exists proves that somebody wrote it, but not necessarily that Joseph Smith did. And because of his youth and inexperience, as we all know, he's an exceedingly unlikely candidate. But where will you find a more likely candidate? Now, this is not the place to go into that problem again. What we're going to do here is point out this neglected aspect of the Book of Mormon, which we believe adds enormously to the difficulty of the already difficult problem of explaining the writing of the Book of Mormon by any normal or abnormal American, or for that matter, any citizen of the world of the 1820s. So thereby we take a step nearer to serious consideration of Joseph Smith's own story of how the Book of Mormon came to be. Admittedly, only sheer desperation would force any schoolman to such an extreme, and they will all simply drop the issue and refuse to discuss it as they do, rather than be forced to such a desperate impasse. But the conscientious student should leave no stone unturned. And we think this stone is a beauty. Approximately 170 pages of the Book of Mormon are taken up with military history. Condensed, fast-moving accounts, all carefully related and interrelated, of warfare at every level, from a two-man patrol to a nation in arms. Ask any college student or any college professor, we'll include even a professor of military strategy and tactics, to sit down and write a long, strictly technical story of ancient warfare out of his own head and make it convincing. Luckily for the student, there's a whole library of Greek and Latin writings describing ancient wars and battles, say nothing of the Bible. They won't help him much. If he tries to take notes from them, he'll be in real trouble, for nothing's more complicated and confusing. His best bet would be to read the whole classical corpus and then simply use his general impressions to make up his story. Well, that's about the best way you would do, but the Book of Mormon writer didn't do that. Didn't do anything like that. All you need to do is to compare Sir Edward Creasy's 15 Battles of the World with the Book of Mormon to see that they move in different worlds. The Book of Mormon wars belong to a world of their own, which makes them all the more easy to check up on. Not the safer, but the more risky for Joseph Smith. For now, the test lies not in searching the library for possible sources, but entirely in the internal consistency and general plausibility of the tale. Let's ask our student or professor, to save him the trouble of back-breaking research, simply to tell his story against the background of the Book of Mormon world. How would it have happened with such a background? Which he's perfectly free to regard it as completely fictitious if he wants. Granted, this is a world that never was. Still, if there had been such a world, then how would they have fought their wars? How would you figure it out? What our student may not know is that there are certain samenesses about wars that is inevitable. That's why I could always bring in the Greeks and Romans when I was running out of Germans to tell the general, the people. he used to sit right up on the front row like that and not move the whole time. We were allowed 10 minutes break at an hour and a half, and then we'd go out for another hour and a half. And you had to dig to get up enough stuff to keep it going, you know, week after week. But it fitted in beautifully. I mean, this old stuff. All wars become very much alike. You know, after they've been going on a while, you run down, the fancy gadgets wear down, and you get down to particular fundamentals. Now, if there was such a world, then how would they have fought their wars? He must therefore take care, since there is a certain sameness, not to be too exotic and peculiar in his account. The red badge of courage could be used for almost any modern war. The long major conflict, no matter where and when it is fought, has certain unfailing characteristics and complications which can be learned only from those who have experienced them, and the Book of Mormon deals with long major conflicts. Here, then, we have two very usable controls of authenticity. First is the difficulty of inventing a long and involved military history without betraying one's hopelessly amateur status. For whoever wrote the Book of Mormon was an amateur, naturally. There were no professionals around then who knew about this. A full generation had passed since Americans had known the meaning of any real war. All this stuff was far away and long ago. There was no one who could handle this. And second is the impossibility of faking a detailed history of a long war. For in every long war, certain things happen in certain ways, and what these things are and how they happen is something no armchair speculation can produce. Well, the war is anything but glamorous in the Book of Mormon. The campaigns and battles are described not as a writer of fiction would depict ancient warfare with all its excitement and color. All that a romantically inclined young American of the 1820s would imagine as the gaudy trappings of heroic derring-do is conspicuously missing. None of the romantic movement here. We have very romantic war stories. It's a real war. It's real war we see here, a tedious, sordid, plodding, joyless routine of seesaw successes and losses, brutally expensive, destructive, exhausting, and boring, with constant marches and countermarches that end sometimes in fiasco and sometimes in intensely unpleasant engagements, which everybody wants to avoid. The author writes as one would write, as only one could write, who had gone through a long war as a frontline observer with his eyes wide open. You'd swear this man had been through the Civil War, but the Civil War didn't come till after. So there's something wrong there. He's guilty of anticipation or something. You see, just to show how standardized these things are, as you know, in German war schools, I don't know whether they still do it in Germany and all European countries, the classic handbooks used for studying of strategy and tactics are from the American Civil War. Those are the classic battles, and they're still used. Of course, Ritchie was only a couple of miles from Gettysburg, and we did all our war problems on the basis of the Battle of Tom's Creek, all the well-known Emmitsburg, all the well-known places in the Civil War. We'd fight those battles over again, and they were just as good, it was just as valid for training as the most modern tactics. We always used the classic battles of the Civil War. The equipment was somewhat different, but that doesn't make as much difference as you'd think. Everything is strictly authentic, with the proper emphasis in the proper place. Strategy and tactics are treated with the knowledge of an expert. Logistics and supply, armaments and fortifications, recruiting and training, problems of morale, support from the home front, military intelligence from cloak and dagger to scouting and patrolling, interrogation, guarding and feeding and exchange of prisoners of war, propaganda and psychological warfare, rehabilitation and resettlement, feelers for peace and negotiations at various levels, treason, profiteering, exploitation of the war, black market. By individuals and groups, it's all there. Well, in the limited time we have, we'll take a few classic instances from the greatest general. Well, the greatest general may have been Mormon. He had the longest career, and he fought these brilliant rear guard actions. But Moroni is certainly the one we know most about. See, he named his son after his hero, Moroni. And Moroni certainly thinks a lot of the early Moroni, doesn't he? If everybody had been like Moroni, he says, the powers of hell would have been stopped cold. But he's the great military genius who takes over at the age of 25. But notice how he operates now. Yes, the later Moroni says, he was a man of perfect understanding. Yea, if all men had been like unto Moroni, behold, the very powers of hell would have been shaken forever. Like most great military leaders, Moroni puts in his appearance only when he is needed in a moment of great national crisis and gracefully retires from the scene as soon as the country is safe. At the age of 39, he retired and he died at 43, apparently of wounds, because we know a number of times received serious wounds. The story begins with a brief introduction, an introductory chapter on Cold War, and this is an extremely instructive chapter on Cold War, the 35th chapter of Alma, which concludes and thus concludes with the same words that Thucydides and Herodotus used, thus the great war began, and the great war between the Persians and the Greeks in one case, and between the Spartans and the Athenians in the other. How did the great war come to pass? Well, this chapter ends, the 13th verse. And thus commenced a war between the Lamanites and the Nephites, and that war lasted 14 years, didn't it? And notice how it began. First, the preaching of the word had more powerful effect. Observing that the preaching of the word had more powerful effect on the minds of the people than the sword or anything else, that's a quotation, Alma had led a very powerful missionary team among the Zoramites, who were these in-between people. You see, you had Zarahemla here, and the Zoramites are somewhere up here. And here is Jershon, their city here, Antionum. Well, we'll keep them here from Zoramites. And then over here, this was wilderness, this was Lehi down here. This would be Jershon here, and, the Zoramites. They go over, the people of Ammon are over here near the coast, aren't they? Here's the people of Ammon over here somewhere. This is purely relative, you see, but this is what happens. The Zoramites were dissenters from the Nephites, who were told would not observe the performances of the church, but had gone off by themselves, and in the best Nephite tradition, founded their own community between the Nephite buffer state of Jershon and the Lamanite-controlled wilderness. So they were between Jershon and the wilderness. See how wrong we are here? Jershon. Here's Jershon. Here's the wilderness. The Zoramites would be in here somewhere, wouldn't they? Yeah. And the main thing is that they split. They split between East Zoram and West Zoram, and West Zoram backs the Nephites backed West Zoram, and the Lamanites backed East Zoram. They both get sucked into this war this way. and they have a long period of Cold War. It was felt that the hostility of the Zoramites and their proximity to the Lamanites posed a definite threat to Nephite security. And that was why Alma, exceedingly sorrowful because of the separation of the Zoramites, when they went over, you see, to here, and sharing concern of his fellow Nephites, who, quote, greatly feared that the Zoramites would enter into correspondence with the Lamanites, gave top priority to the Zoramite mission. The preaching of the brethren proved highly successful among one segment of the Zoramite population, and thereby greatly alarmed the rest. For there was a great social unrest among the Zoramites at the time. Alma and Amulek had preached to throngs of people, poor people, sitting on the ground, whose leaders complained that they were despised and cast out of our synagogues, which we have labored abundantly to build with our own hands. This is very condensed here, but we're going to get the situation up. It was among this oppressed minority that the missionaries had their success, causing, quote, the more popular part of the Zoramites to become alarmed and take counteraction, holding angry meetings to discuss the alien teaching that did destroy their craft. The authorities, their rulers and their priests and their teachers, they are called, without letting the public know what they were doing, secretly started checking up on everybody. Quote, therefore, they found out privily the minds of all the people, and anyone known to have been sympathetic to the teaching of the missionaries, those who were in favor of the word spoken by Alma and his brethren were cast out of the land, and they were many. So they found out what people were thinking, they got rid of them. So where did they go? They went over and joined the people of Ammon here. There's a migration here after Alma and his friends had left the city, finished their mission, they were forced to leave. Then large numbers of these people followed them and were welcomed here. And this is where the trouble begins. It will be recalled that the Nephites considered it, quote, strictly contrary to the commands of God that there should be any law against a man's belief. But these people had descended away from the Nephites in preference for a way of life that combined a great display of religious piety with an even more impressive display of clothes and jewelry, their costly apparel and their ringlets and their bracelets and their ornaments of gold and all their precious things, and behold, their hearts are set upon them. And yet they cry unto thee and say, we thank thee, O God, for we are a chosen people unto thee, while others shall perish. Such people were in no mood to listen to the word, for it did destroy their craft, therefore they would not hearken unto the words of Alma. Well, all this is relevant to show that behind the great war that follows, there's an ideological, quote, conflict. It was natural that the followers of Nephite missionaries, being expelled from their own land, should follow their spiritual leaders, quote, also into the land of Jershon, that being the nearest territory under Nephite influence. And it was also natural that the inhabitants of Jershon, the pacifist Ammonites, who were themselves refugees from the Lamanites, they had, notice how extremely complicated the picture of race and nation is if you start running it down in the Book of Mormon. It's anything but the dark and the light, the good and the bad, the Nephites versus the Lamanites. And it's an extremely complicated picture, and this is just typical. It was also natural the inhabitants who were themselves refugees from the Lamanites should give them asylum. And they did nourish them and did clothe them and did give unto them lands for their inheritance. They rehabilitated them there. Well, the Zoramites promptly lodged an official protest through their leader with the Ammonites, requesting them to deport their Zoramite refugees, just as the Nazis protested asylum given to outcast citizens by the Danes and the Dutch and so forth, and used that as an issue to stir up war and to invade those countries. They actually did. And just as the Nazis issued grim warnings to those who did not heed such requests and used the situation to stir up crises and issue ultimatums, so the Zoramites, when the people of Ammon refused to comply, quote, breathed out many threatenings against them through their chief ruler, a very wicked man, unquote. And they used the occasion to bring on a crisis between the Nephites and the Lamanites. For they did just what the Nephites had feared and began to mix with the Lamanites and to stir them up also to anger against them. So on one side, you have the Zoramites, who had gone and settled in Jershon, the Zoramites going over and trying to stir up the Lamanites, saying, look, our people have left. They've gone over to the Ammonites who've just left you not long ago. They're descendants from you. Look what they're doing. They're building up a big military force right on your border. You're going to be in danger. And they used the Lamanites to bring them. They sucked them in that way, pointing out to them the people of Ammon, lately descended from the Lamanites, were now building up strength by receiving more dissenters into their midst. And this with the obvious approval and assistance of the Nephites. Thus, two small states set against each other, that is, the Ammonites and the Zoramites, set against each other by each appealing to a great power, set against each other by each appealing to a great power, set two great powers against each other. And thus, We're quoting the Book of Mormon. Now, the Zoramites and the Lamanites began to make preparations for war against the people of Ammon and also against the Nephites. See, the Zoramites and Lamanites are now making common cause. This is all the 35th chapter of Alma. Against the people of Ammon and also against the Nephites. They brought the Nephites into it. It's a story that's become painfully familiar in our day. The same thing that happened in Korea and Vietnam and so forth when a split between two people, two ideologies, bring two different sides in together. So far, there had been no military action. This is strictly Cold War, you'll notice. The next step was for the Nephites to evacuate the Ammonites from Jershon, moving them to Melek, which is over here someplace. Oh, that map is no good, is it? But they evacuated from this area now. They evacuated the Ammonites and moved them to Melek. Jershon thus returned to its old status as a defense zone, now offering the Nephites a clear field of fire as the operation, quote, gave place in the land of Jershon for the armies of the Nephites that they might contend with the armies of the Lamanites. Gave place. You had to leave a field of fire. You have to make it free. So they moved out the pacifist farmers, the Ammonites. But it's very interesting thing that the Zoramites, refugees, remained behind because they weren't under an oath not to fight. And they remained behind and took up arms and waited for the event. So with mounting tensions and threats, with each side feeling itself increasingly endangered by the other, the Cold War moved into a hot war. The Ammonites, being pacifists, moved out of the war zone, but the recent Zoramite refugees stayed on and armed themselves, we're told in 35:14. The Nephites felt as insecure as the Lamanites, and with good reason. This is not going to be a war of good guys against bad guys. What is worrying Alma was the decline of Nephite morality. When Nephites and Lamanites lock horns, there is little to choose between them in the matter of good or bad. That was the promise. What grieved Alma at this time was, quote, the wars and the bloodsheds and contentions which were among the Nephites themselves. He, we're told in the first verse of the 43rd chapter, has visited every city or sent a son to that city. He had a report from every city of the Nephites and found the conditions deplorable in each city. He had visited every city in the land and found the country in this state. The hearts of the people began to wax hard. They refused to listen to his preaching. So he sent his sons forth on special missions. This is his famous blessings on his three sons. Sent his sons forth on special missions to the people, and also he himself could not rest, and he also went forth to preach. They felt this was the best thing they could do and the thing that really needed to be done, because the Nephites were in a bad state. They never fight the Lamanites when they're... But the Lord had told Nephi that already in the second chapter of the Book of Mormon. Remember, they shall have no power over you as long as you hearken to me. You should have no power. You don't have to worry about them. When you weaken yourselves, that the issue with them comes up. Well, now we have the trouble with Zarahemla. This is a good episode. It shows Alma in action here. The Zoramites now severed. Notice the steps are so perfectly natural, exactly what you'd expect in the newspaper. What would be the next step? The Zoramites now severed all connections with the Nephites, and they took the name of Lamanites and considered themselves Lamanites henceforth. See, they'd have nothing to do anymore. They'd had broken off from the coalition. And they invited the Lamanite, next step, they invited the Lamanite hordes to move in and occupy their country as the first major move against the Nephites. At their head, the Lamanites, came the Lamanite commander-in-chief, the Amalekite Zarahemla. The Amalekites were Nephite dissenters of an earlier day, still more complications, you see, who'd gone over and become joined with the Zoramites, and like most dissenters, were more bitter against the Nephites and of a more wicked and murderous disposition than the Lamanites were, says Alma. Zarahemla had seen to it that all the key commands in the army had gone to Amalekites like himself or to equally ferocious Zoramites. This wasn't a Lamanite show at all. The whole thing was being engineered by Zoramites and Amalekites. So we see the Nephites being punished for their own wickedness in more ways than one. In fact, the Lamanites appear at times as no more than simple-minded tools of Nephite or ex-Nephite wickedness. Certainly, Zarahemla was using them as his cat's paw, for behold, his designs were to stir up the Lamanites to anger against the Nephites. This he did that he might usurp great power. His career, you see. Another familiar story. The hate campaign is a means to personal power. Zarahemla really worked on this. He worked on the Lamanite resentment of the people of Ammon, especially their own people, so you'd gone over and dissented and so forth, whom they regarded as traitors, conveniently overlooking the fact that his own people were dissenters from the Nephites. And in time, he found himself in command of a huge coalition army against the Nephites, who understandably felt themselves desperately threatened. At this moment, the 25-year-old Moroni appears on the scene, a military genius if there ever was one. He introduced improvements in armor to make his people far more than a match, man for man, for the enemy. He arranged the Jershon defense zone, and being on the defensive and greatly outnumbered, was particularly diligent in keeping a sharp lookout on all enemy movements. At the same time, inquiring of the holy prophet Alma, after what is now known to have been an ancient custom in Israel, this Professor Yadin, the great Israeli archaeologist and general, their best antiquarian, in his book on the Milchama, the battle scroll, notes that in ancient Israel it was the custom, according to the scrolls, always to consult a prophet to find out where the enemy's dispositions were and where they should go and so forth. This is exactly what he does, see. He doesn't go himself. Notice he sends messengers to Alma to ask him where, Alma being out preaching, where he should meet them and what was happening. Now, he was preparing to meet them in Jershon. Jershon was the front line defense. There should be over there, incidentally. And moving it all over the place. He was expecting them confidently to come to Jershon. That's the land that had been vacated because it was nearest. It was the most exposed. It was a big bulge there. And he had all his forces there, and he would have been completely caught off guard because Zerahemna was very cute. He didn't go to Jershon at all. He made a lightning thrust against Manti, which was way down here in the corner, and it was for that reason weakly defended. They never thought he'd hit from there. But Alma told Moroni that that's what he'd do, so Moroni was able to save the day. Without that, they would have lost everything. But he brought this phase of the war to a quick end because of the inspired guidance of Alma. So he asked Alma regarding the enemy's plan of battle, whither the armies of the Nephites should go to defend themselves against the Lamanites. On the other hand, the Lamanite campaign was directed by Amalekite and Zoramite officers. They had an advantage, too, because they'd all been Nephite trained. They knew all the Nephite tricks and their military secrets and methods, and this would have given them an enormous advantage over any commander but Moroni. Right at the outset, his foresight had robbed them of their first logical objective, the buffer land of Jershon. He had taken his main defense position there, but when the messengers returned from consulting the prophet, he learned that the Lamanites were planning a surprise attack by directing their push against the more inaccessible but weaker land of Manti, where they would not be expected. Immediately, Moroni moved his main army into Manti and put the people there in a state of preparedness. Informed of every Lamanite move by his spies and scouts, Moroni was able to lay a trap for the enemy, catching them off guard as they were fording the riverside. This is the Battle of Ripla, which is a very good example. It's the four phases of the battle. First, there's the approach march. Zerahemna comes up here. He's going as fast as he can. He's going to surprise Manti, and he has to cross the river to get there. So they know the place where he has to cross the ford, and they're waiting for him. And there's the Mount Ripla here, and here is Lehi, a very ferocious, a very competent and aggressive general. He's placed with a small force here, and they let the marching line go back. Establishes his army post on Zerahemna, on the bank of the river here, and he starts to cross here, a slower operation. Slowing down, when they're slowed down, then he attacks their rear here. Lehi attacks their rear. He has strict instructions not to touch the water. He must not advance into the river. Let them cross. Let them get over here. Because on the other side, there's what's called the West Valley. Moroni had prepared emplacements waiting for them, not very strongly manned, to engage them as they came over. They were able to break through there. Moroni was concealed behind the hill here, and he hit them both sides. He's concealed, all right. And yes, he is. I'm the only one who can see him. They went over, and the greatly superior forces of the Lamanites carried them through, and it says they fought desperately, and they nearly turned it, and what saved the day was Moroni's reserves. He had reserves back of both hills here, the other side, which formed the West Valley. And so the Lamanites regrouped and fell back, and here they were surrounded on all sides, and there they surrendered, and here it was on the plain by the river that they had the parley with Zerahemna that he talks about. Yeah. Which one? The cowpens, what they call cowpens. Yes, it was. You get them in a box canyon. You put them in there. They had it all laid. He wanted them to go through, though. They wanted to break them down. They have various names for these. You give mostly the German names, anyway. But here he inserts an apology. The younger Moroni inserts an apology for the use of espionage, which he realizes is not playing fair. But he says, since it was only the desire of the Nephites to preserve their lands and their liberty, therefore he thought it no sin that he should defend them by stratagem. The ensuing episode shows what a stickler Moroni really was for fair play, though. This isn't just rhetoric here. The battle at the ford was called the work of death. No glamour and no glory. After they'd crossed the river and collided with Moroni's reserves in the West Valley, the Lamanites were at bay. But this was only their first setback, and they did fight like dragons. But the Nephites had the better cause. The younger Moroni explained, since they were fighting strictly on the defensive. This was no pious cant, for the Nephites in this case were really not the aggressors, and they never are. They had observed the rule that God had given them. Inasmuch as ye are not guilty of the first offense, we're told in Alma 43, neither the second, ye shall not suffer them yourselves to be slain. This is the law of the third offense. It was observed, in the letter at least, by the Romans and the Jews. Always observed the law. The law of the fecialis, you throw the three lances at the enemy over the... Give him the three chances. Well, it's the same thing in the Dar al-Harb, the rule of war with the Muslims. You always give the enemy three chances to accept Islam, and then you shoot. See? Do you, bang. But it's supposed to give him a good fair chance, you see. He can attack you three times. The third time, you fight back. But you don't do it otherwise. Inasmuch as you're not guilty of the first... The Lamanites, on the other hand, were fighting, we're told, for monarchy and power and made no secret of their intention of subduing and ruling. Even so, the ancient rule of the third offense rendered preventive warfare out of the question. We'll see that all wars between the Lamanites and the Nephites are fought on Nephite territory. They're never invading Lamanite territory. I don't know a single instance. Well, the sorely pressed Lamanites, by flocking together for protection, as beaten armies usually do, made it all easier for Moroni and his carefully hoarded reserves to surround them. Then he immediately called a halt to the fighting. Now Moroni, when he saw their terror, commanded his men that they should stop shedding their blood. He had them fall back. He said he had his army fall back, and he went out personally with a small guard to meet Zarahemla, telling him, "We do not desire to be men of blood. Ye know that ye are in our hands. We do not desire to slay you." You see, now, here was Moroni's chance to settle the Lamanite problem once for all on the spot. A vastly superior force had entered and ravaged large parts of his country, bent on subduing it entirely, and now he had them, as he said, completely in his power. Well, might he have said, kill or be killed, it's either you or us. Finish them off. But instead of that type of victory, and Moroni always avoids that, he did not even ask for unconditional surrender. Of course, that's an oxymoron anyway, unconditional surrender, since everybody surrenders at least on condition of his life being spared. No such thing as unconditional surrender. All he asked, well, that's a condition, and rather an important one, isn't it? All he asked of his bloodthirsty foe was that they deliver up their weapons and promise not to fight the Nephites anymore. Then they could go their way in peace, without reprisals, punishment, hostages, or guaranteed. He felt perfectly secure in taking such a step, and he explains it to the incredulous Zarahemla. He says, yes, this is all... Zarahemla was cynical. He wouldn't believe this. He reminded Zarahemla, he says, ye see that God will support and keep and preserve us so long as we are faithful to him. You can't beat us, he says. You see it yourself. Much inferior force, much smaller Nephite force had got them all surrendering here. Well, Zarahemla handed over his sword to Moroni, but his hatred of the Nephites only heightened by his humiliating defeat. And he cynically and realistically observed in so doing that there was no point to taking such an oath, he said, which ye know we shall break. We'll break it, he says, and you know we will, so why ask an oath like that? He reciprocated Moroni's gallantry and humanity by accusing him of not playing fair. He says, you only won because you stratagem. You cheated, you rascal. And he flatly refused the original terms. Instead of ordering his insulting and threatening adversary cut down on the spot, Moroni handed him back his sword with an invitation. He says, okay, we'll end the conflict. But at the same time, indicating his reluctance to do so, he says he's forced into this position because he says, I cannot recall the words which I have spoken. He said, we'd have to finish it if you didn't accept. But again, he points out to the Lamanites their hopeless position and again invites them to accept his easy conditions. In the 11th verse, this is the 44th chapter. He was willing to discuss things to the end, but Zarahemla put an end to the conference, which was so much to his advantage, by madly rushing Moroni with the sword he had given him. He was intercepted, but went down fighting with the top of his scalp missing. The guard, who had cut it off, put it on the end of his sword and held it up for Zarahemna's men to see, at the same time repeating once again Moroni's offer of an easy peace. By this time, the Lamanites were impressed, and many accepted the offer, being forthwith, we're told, suffered to depart into the wilderness without prejudice or penalty. The oath was indeed binding on these people, yet Zarahemla had served notice that though he might take an oath, he wouldn't keep it. Whilst the prisoners were being released, Zarahemla, You can still stir around without the top of your head for a while. We never read him, hear of him in a later engagement. This is the last we hear of him. Zerahemnah stirred up some of his diehard supporters and turned savagely on the Nephites in a wild melee. This time, Moroni had had enough of the obnoxious Zoramites and gave the order to let them have it. But very quickly, Zerahemnah and his crew knew they were beaten. Again, Moroni instantly stopped the fighting and caused that the work of death should cease again. And after they, including Zerahemnah himself, had entered into a covenant with him of peace, they were suffered to depart into the wilderness. So they lived to fight another day, though Zerahemnah, lacking his scalp, is never heard of again, as Moroni knew they would. He would have been justified in view of Zerahemnah's threats in finishing him off as a preventive measure by modern standards, but he would not condemn them for a crime they had not yet committed. And in offering them a chance to sin again was also offering them a chance to repent and become his friends, which, as we shall see, many of them later did. This policy really paid off in the long run. Well, then we skip down here to the trouble with Amalickiah. It was not long after this that the sinister figure of Amalickiah appeared on the scene to undo all that Moroni had been fighting for. Amalickiah is one of a line of brilliant troublemakers who keep things stirred up through the turbulent pages of the Book of Mormon. Beginning with Laman and Lemuel, we meet in order Sherem, Amulam, Nehor, Amalickiah, Zizram, Korihor, Zerahemnah, and now, neither last nor least, Amalickiah. All of these men had certain traits in common. All were personally ambitious and unscrupulous, aspiring to be either king or religious head of the people. All were powerful speakers and clever propagandists, skilled in the use of flattering words. All sought to undermine, if they could, not seize the highest authority of the church and state, being particularly opposed to popular government and drawing their support from those who sought to overthrow it. Of these, the most dangerous yet to appear was certainly Amalickiah. During the post-war boom, there was a strong tendency to ignore the admonitions of Helaman, the new spiritual head of the nation, as people, quote, grew proud, being lifted up in their hearts because of their exceeding great riches. Helaman's unyielding position became a great annoyance to those people whose hearts were set on the things of the new prosperity, and they formed an opposition party under this Amalickiah, who welded it together from various elements. His object was to become king. And he started out as head of the most violent of factions, organized in high anger and out to kill, gathered together against their brethren, exceeding wrath, determined to slay them. To these, by promises of high office and power, he added a host of ambitious local officials, lower judges of the land, seeking for power, we're told. These were those lawmen who'd plotted against Helaman's father Alma when he had been head of the state, and of whom he said, "The foundation of the destruction of this people is beginning to be laid by the unrighteousness of your lawyers and your judges." This was the crowd that Amalickiah was enlisting. To the royalists and ambitious lawyers, Amalickiah added a third force, those people who professed the blood of nobility. Such would have been the great families and the kindreds mentioned later on in 3 Nephi. Finally, there were many in the church who believed in the flattering words of Amalickiah, we're told, who obviously told them what they wanted to hear. Well, this was what was backing Amalickiah. It was a dangerous coalition to be threatening a government which had barely succeeded in making a precarious peace with a foreign enemy of vastly superior forces, and thus were the affairs of the people of Nephi exceedingly precarious and dangerous. Thus we see, reflects Moroni, how quick the children of men do forget, and we also see the great wickedness one very wicked man can cause. No one saw more clearly than Moroni where this was leaning. All that he had achieved with great toil and danger was going to be thrown away if he did not act quickly. Angry with Amalickiah, we're told, he reacted with that speed and decision which is the mark of the great leader in the field. Raising his title of liberty, according to the ancient custom, this is a very ancient and well-established one, as the type of the torn garment of the outcast Joseph, the symbol of the poor and outcast of Israel, he announced to the people, quote, "Surely God shall not suffer that we who are despised because we take upon us the name of Christ shall be trodden down until we bring it upon ourselves." Then behold, we're told, the people came running, arming themselves as they came and rending their garments and casting them at Moroni's feet in the ancient gesture of covenant and submission. In the last issue of the History of Religions, an article by Zachariah Smith called the treading on the garments. It was an old Jewish custom. When you made a covenant like this, you would tread on your garments. And this is what these people do. Thus Moroni rallied the people in defense of the constitution of Mosiah, of government, it says, by the voice of the people against the coalition of royalists, that's what they're called in Reynolds' Concordance, self-styled nobility and ambitious local officials who sought to destroy it in a time of national emergency. Things were getting hot for Amalickiah, who accordingly tried to make a break for it and join the Lamanites. Well, this sort of thing had happened before, and Moroni knew that it would wreck his hard-bought peace, for he knew that he would stir up the Lamanites to anger that he might obtain his purpose. Well, to check this move, Moroni thought it was expedient to force a peace on the dissenters with all possible haste. Moving with his usual dispatch, he intercepted them before they got out of the country, made them surrender to him, required them to take an oath, a covenant to keep the peace, and not fight against their own government. You couldn't ask for less than that. No citizen could give less, and those who refused knowingly accepted the status of combatants and could expect to be treated as such. At the time, Moroni was acting with special military powers given him, quote, by the chief judges and the voice of the people, unquote, and accordingly put to death as an enemy in arms those who refused to lay down their arms, but it says these were only a few. Instead of a blanket order for the extermination of all Amalekites as traitors in the modern fashion, Moroni merely exacted from them a promise to support the government during a dire national emergency. Well, Moroni had been right about Amalickiah, though, for that hero escaped into the wilderness, made his way to the Lamanites, and did stir up the Lamanites to anger against the people of Nephi to such a degree that the Lamanite king ordered a general mobilization for war. Then his hanky-panky with the court and so forth, how he got himself ahead. But his big problem, once he got into high position, you see, I mean, he even got to be king, you notice, Amalickiah did. His big problem, however, was to get the Lamanites to fight for him. And no professional public relations office could have done a more skillful job than he did. See, they just had their fill of war. They just had enough, and nobody wanted to fight. So this is what he did. He did appoint men to speak unto the Lamanites from their towers against the Nephites. Trained orators delivered set speeches from the official information centers, accusing, always accusing, against the Nephites. And thus did he inspire their hearts against the Nephites, until by the end of the year they were howling for blood. For he had hardened the hearts of the Lamanites and blinded their minds and stirred them up to ardor by a regular systematic. He didn't have a radio or TV, but he had these special towers, and he would send his trained speakers out to give speeches against the Nephites. How much Joseph Smith knows about these things? These are new techniques, you see. Now he had no trouble raising an army, his object being to reign over all the land, the Nephites as well as the Lamanites. Moroni, as you might suppose, was not idle during this time. Now he makes a great defensive order, and his defensive skill is very great. Instead of fighting fire with fire, he prepared the minds of the people to be faithful, Alma says. At the same time, building up a marvelously well-conceived system of defense in depth for the Nephites. Indeed, all of Moroni's strategy and tactics are dictated by the necessity of meeting vastly superior numbers at all times. If his strategy was necessarily defensive, so was his psychology. Quote, for he did not delight in bloodshed, Moroni the Younger reminds us again and again, but did labor exceedingly for the welfare and safety of his people. He had sworn to defend them, he had taught them to defend themselves, but at the same time never to give offense and never to raise the sword except it were to preserve their lives. For their part, it says, the people were compelled reluctantly to contend with their brethren the Lamanites. And when they took the field, it was notwithstanding their much reluctance. They were sorry to take up arms against the Lamanites because they did not delight in the shedding of blood. They were sorry to be the means of sending so many of their brethren out of this world. This was Moroni's own attitude, and like Alma, he insists on designating the enemy as his brethren, and he means it. This, then, would seem to be a case of the good people against the bad people, until we remember that the Lamanites were equally reluctant to fight the Nephites. Nobody wanted this war. Our story being a lesson in the great wickedness one very wicked man can cause. Well, Moroni's defenses were based on a series of strong points, being a defense in depth, as modern defense lines are. And, of course, when you have a superior force, that's the only thing you can do. It's the only way you can take the momentum out of it. Besides specially placed small forts, or places of resort, they're called, towns and cities on the line were also converted into strong points. Such an arrangement, this is the Igelstellung, this is the Maginot arrangement. The Siegfried line was a defense in depth. We call them pillboxes, they were called pillboxes. And the thing is, you have to, no matter how superior a force is, you have these strong places here, they can communicate with each other, and you can't bypass them, you see, without being cut off. They can cut off your supplies, so you have to slow down to reduce one by one. Or what can you do? You can't bypass them and leave them behind you. They'll slow you down no matter what happens. They can't beat you. You're much stronger, and you have freedom of motion and so forth. But you can't leave them behind you, and you can't just pass them. You do it where you can, but there are cities too. See, they set up these special small forts or places of resort, meaning they were very mobile, they could fall back on them, and the towns and cities were also converted into strong places. Such an arrangement can take the momentum out of any military steamroller and slow down or stop any attacking forces, no matter how formidable, by forcing it to reduce one strong place after another. Well, even the Belgians, who were not expecting the Germans in 1914 at all, in von Gluck's great push to the North Sea, the great right-wing swing into France there, were able to slow them down and wreck their schedule completely. just by putting up a token resistance because they had a few forts in Belgium. Antwerp was a very strongly fortified place. They were old-fashioned, they were archaic forts, but they slowed them down and they stopped the... They turned the tide of war, actually, because they had these strong places. And he's able to do the same thing here. See, what they do is enable you to gather your forces for a counterattack while they're being embarrassed here. By forcing it to reduce one place after another, or else bypass the fortifications, and thereby leave dangerous enemy forces in its rear to disrupt communications and launch harassing counterattacks on invading units. With this strictly defensive program, the preparation being to fight, if at all, only on their own grounds. And an early warning system was important. You can't, as Churchill always says, you can't be strong everywhere. For victory, and of course this is the theory of Clausewitz and of all the German general staff after the war of 1870, namely, you must be overwhelmingly strong at one point. Then you win. You break through, and then you spread out, and then you roll up the line. The conventional things. But you must be overwhelmingly strong at one point. You can't expect to be strong everywhere. So you have to take calculated risks everywhere else on the line just so you can be overwhelmingly strong at one particular point and then break through. But for this, what if you're on the defensive, though? You have to be strong along the whole line. You have to be strong everywhere because he can hit you anywhere he wants, you see, without warning. What can you do? Well, for this defensive, then, especially if you're far inferior in numbers, you need an early warning system. And it was Moroni's idea that God himself would provide such a system if the people were only faithful. If they were faithful in keeping the commandments of God, that he would warn them to flee or to prepare for war according to the danger. And also God would make it known unto them whither they should flee and whether they should go to defend themselves. In other words, whether there was to be attack or not, whether they should mobilize or not, God would let them know. And where should they direct their limited forces? Since they couldn't be strong everywhere, God would tell them where, as he told Alma. Well, that's a good system to have. It works, you see. That saves them keeping a whole nation in arms all the time, waiting, waiting, waiting for somebody to strike. In short, God was their dew line, their radar and warning system, and it saved them the need of constant and costly vigilance on all fronts, to say nothing of expensive and wasteful war plans and war games, which have to be going on all the time. We're told this was Moroni's policy of preparedness. This was the faith of Moroni, and his heart did glory in it. Not in the shedding of blood, but in doing good. It keeps hammering away at that. He did not believe in shedding blood. And he was conservative. He always spared, always spared. He was as considerate of the enemy as he was of himself. The minute a battle turned, let's stop it now. And the keystone of all defense was unity at home. And for this, the sons of Alma, Helaman and his brethren, were no less serviceable unto the people than was Moroni. For they did preach the word of God, and the people did humble themselves. And thus they were free from wars and contentions among themselves, which was always the main source of danger, according to Alma. Well, now, he in various operations here with Amalekiah, when they struck, remember, they found these strong places and the new preparations and the new fancy fortifications and the armor. They hadn't expected these things at all. They expected they were going to fight the last war. They expected it would be a pushover. And this is exactly what Moroni wanted them to expect. So they were taken in spite of the fact, and they shouldn't have been, but this always happens. All great wars begin with a series of nasty surprises by all concerned, because they're prepared in terms of the last war, even though they have reason for believing they shouldn't be. The whole first year of World War I, the French wore bright red pants, all the army. But they were bitterly disappointed because they put all their preparations in the Vosges. They expect the Germans to come through Mulhouse and strike in the south there, and they didn't. But the Germans had signaled their punch for months, showed exactly where they were coming. But they were brutally surprised. They never expected that the English would support France at all, the few English units over there. The one thing that von Kluck said completely flabbergasted him. He never expected the resilience, the comeback of the French soldiers. After they were beaten, they came back. And he never expected that. Spoiled his whole plan, everything. But they should have known these things, but they don't. Now, Napoleon says the one duty of a general is never to be surprised. But these generals were surprised, and they were mad. And they took an oath that they would go and wipe out the city of Noah. Here was an undefended city. They would hit it fast and make it an object lesson, exactly as the Germans did of Antwerp when they failed to get let through, when they failed to get through Belgium, when the Belgians resisted them and slowed them down. They made an example of Antwerp. They burned the greatest documents library in the world, and it horrified everybody. But they thought this would show that they meant monkey business, and nobody would dare to resist them forever after. Well, it didn't work. They tried that policy again and again, and it backfired. But this is what these generals do. They took an oath to destroy Noah. Now, Moroni decided that that's exactly what they would do, so he just invited them to come to Noah. See? And he had a special preparation there, a beautiful gate, a very strongly fortified key arrangement at a gate there that couldn't be assaulted directly. But they'd taken their officer's oath. They'd taken their officer's oath to die or take that. And in one after another, suicide assaults on that gate, all their officers were killed. They lost 1,000 men. They lost all their officers. They marched back home and told, what's his name? It's Malachi now. And he was fit to be tied. There he is. The supreme test of generalship, we're told, is to have the enemy play your game, making just the moves you want him to make, under the impression that he's being very smart on his own. Moroni did just that. The attack on the city of Noah, we're told, was according to his desires. He devised a new and ingenious type of defense for the city gate, which proved a death trap for the Lamanites. Now, so, well, so the great and carefully planned offensive, with all its high hopes for a quick victory, fizzled out, and the beaten army went back to report to the infuriated Führer. In a towering rage, well, infuriated, listen to this, exceeding wroth, he did curse God and also Moroni, swearing with an oath that he would drink his blood. He was mad, you see. He was fit to be tied. At every step in his career, he'd found that man Moroni barring the way. And at every step in the campaign of his own army had played into the hands of that Moroni. No wonder Moroni was beginning to be an obsession with him. Moroni was getting under his skin. Well, peace again brought prosperity, but Moroni was not idle. He launched out on an ambitious program of national fortification, displaying his usual genius in the design and disposal of strong places. First of all, it was necessary to remove a dangerous salient, a bulge, over on the east coast. You see why that would be. Well, it gives us the reason, and very good in the book of Mormon. This is straightening out your lines of big things. See, here's the coast along here. Well, you can't have a bulge here. He's practically invaded you there. Moreover, you have a much longer line to keep, and everything's very awkward. So his first concern is to straighten out that bulge over on the east coast. It was cleared of Lamanites and settled by local people and colonists from Zarahemla. This way, Moroni was able to shorten and strengthen his defense line, we're told in verse 8 of the 50th chapter now. And having determined the best possible course for the line, he proceeded to fortify it along its entire length from the east wilderness, north of Jershon on the coast, to the West Sea. Again, employing not a single wall, but a defense in depth, including even the founding of new fortified towns and strategically located places by the borders. So he had people go out and they settled towns along the borders there. First, they got the shortest possible line, then he surveyed for the most effective defense line, and then he proceeded to occupy it by permanent settlers, very much like the Roman limes. See, they would settle their troops there and set them up as farmers and so forth, and many of us are descendants. You'd be surprised of soldiers, Roman soldiers, who settled along the various limes, Hadrian's Wall, whether it be in England or along the Danube front or along the Rhine. But they mixed with people, intermarried, and became farmers there, and you find lots of Roman names and Roman faces on earth. From that. Well, this is the method he uses there, and it's a very good one. At the same time, he effected a gradual buildup of military powers within the country, we're told, though his principal concern was ever to keep the peace at home, knowing, quote, that it had been their quarrelings and their contentions and their abominations, which were among themselves, which brought upon them their wars and their destruction. It wasn't the wicked Lamanites at all. What brought the Lamanites on them were their wars and their bickerings among themselves. We'll see how time goes. Well, then we have another coalition to fight and so forth. I see the time runs very fast here. This emergency now, the trouble with... he has to put up the banner of the title of liberty again. Then the trouble with Amoron and the 3,000 sons. Well, here we got a good example of strategy. Let's take this one. Things look very bad indeed for Moroni in those dangerous circumstances. Amoron, see, the brother and successor of Amalickiah. During the war that followed, the Nephites, with their inferior numbers, were forced to fight that kind of a war that all commanders dread more than anything else, war on two fronts. They had to fight an army in the east and the west, and notice the clever Lamanite, Amoron, knew how to take advantage of that, and he worked that for all it was worth, we're told. Amoron, the brother and successor of Amalickiah, made the most of this advantage to himself and sent a strong diversionary force to occupy Moroni, and if possible, split the Nephite force even more, while harassing them everywhere and keeping them off balance by sallies and infiltrations from the numerous former Nephite strong places now held by the Lamanites. He launched a thunderbolt attack down the coast and really just swept in steamroller. He took one strong place after another. When the people started retreating from the one to the next, it built up, and the Lamanites had taken everything. They took all of Moroni's strong place and everything. It was a terrible setback. Things looked very bad indeed for Moroni in those dangerous circumstances. So here was a situation that would test his skill to the utmost, and he rose to the occasion. Well, what would you do in a situation like that? First, he ordered Teancum, his most mobile general with some very crack troops and very fast moving, to sit tight on his sector while harassing the Lamanites as much as possible and keeping a sharp lookout for any chance, opportunity, or opening to do them real damage. That's about all he could do, you see. At the same time, he was instructed to take and keep as many prisoners of war as possible with a view to future exchange of prisoners with the Lamanites, for the addition of one man to the Nephite force meant far more than it did to the Lamanites. Moroni followed up with these instructions, quote, with orders to make an attack on the city of Mulek. He said, we have to get things going. We can't let a stalemate occur here because they're building strength all the time. So he says, attack and take Mulek, if possible. Moroni to Teancum. Teancum said, nothing doing. He was on the ground and he saw it was too strong, so we just refused. For Moroni was determined to get things moving. It's a neatly authentic touch, however, that Teancum, after sizing up the situation, decided against an attack on Mulek, and sat and waited in Bountiful for Moroni to show up. Bountiful was their northernmost strong point, the one thing they always held on to after everything else had been lost. When the commander-in-chief finally got through with an army, he left the west coast behind, left his west army, and came to join the forces and try to get things moving with Teancum here in the east, and then there was trouble immediately with his army back there. Oh, they're having a time of it. But he got there, and they held a top-level council of war. It was at once convened to study the situation. At this conference, it was agreed that the first thing on the agenda was for the united forces of Teancum and Moroni to take the city of Mulek, which was the eastern anchor of the main defense line. But how was a major city, superbly fortified by Moroni's own foresight, to be taken? The first step was a logical one. It was the ancient custom of warfare to invite the occupants of a city to come out on the open plain and engage in a fair set contest, or as the Nephites put it, on fair grounds. We recently have an article in Political Quarterly on this very thing, this very sort of thing. You invite them. This is routine. It goes back to very ancient times. You invite them to come out on fair grounds and meet you on the field of battle. Invite them to come out of their city. You don't have to, and they don't have to. But it's the normal thing, and they do it in the Book of Mormon. They call it upon fair grounds, which is the correct expression that was used. The Nephite commanders, in issuing such an invitation to the comfortably ensconced opposition, hardly expected the Lamanites to comply with a request so disadvantageous to themselves, but we're told they thought it was worth a try, and at any rate, it was the conventional thing to do. The next, see, always try what you can, and then do something else. Their next move was to try a decoy trick. Teancum allowed the Lamanites to discover a task force of his moving along the coast and give it chase. Moroni then slipped into the city behind them and overpowered the defenders, characteristically sparing all who yielded up their arms. Then he took the coast route on the heels of the Lamanites, who were chasing Teancum. So you have the Lamanite chasing Teancum and Moroni chasing the Lamanites. As a secondary diversion, a small Nephite force under the terrible Lehi had issued from the west side there out of the main base at Bountiful and met the Lamanites head on. Confused by this new development, as like a bear at bay with a pack of dogs around it, the Lamanites sought counsel in safety by returning to Mulek, their base. And as they turned back, they remembered, hey, we didn't leave many people in Mulek, and they started, for all they were worth, to get back there before the Nephites would get it. And it turned out to be a mad race for Mulek, not knowing that the Nephites had already taken it, you see. So their return to Mulek turned into a wild race with the Nephites to see who would get there first. Bent only on reaching home base in safety, the exhausted Lamanites, with Lehi hot behind them, ran smack into Moroni's army coming up behind them. It was the last straw. With his usual forbearance, Moroni waved total victory and spared all the Lamanites who'd stopped fighting him. But their leader was Jacob, a Zoramite, who hated the Nephites as only a dissenter could hate. With an elite guard, he tried to fight his way out of the sack, but died in the attempt. Moroni immediately offered the usual easy terms to his followers. Now Moroni, seeing their confusion, said unto them, if you will bring forth your weapons of war and deliver them up to us, behold, we will forbear shedding your blood. Even so, those who were not surrendered were not killed, but disarmed, bound, and marched off to the great central prison compound at Bountiful, which this becomes a big problem now, prisoners of war. Because the prisoner of war problem was now becoming very serious for the Nephites. Their best solution was to put their prisoners to work, which Moroni, we're told, was compelled to do because it was easy to guard them while at their work. And the Nephites were frightfully short of manpower. That's against the Geneva Convention, making them work on their own in prison. But he said that was the best way to keep them out of trouble and to watch them. And so they made a very strong stalag of Bountiful. It was the main one. They got thousands and thousands of prisoners there, and it's their main base here. With a ditch and breastworks, more of Moroni's ingenuity, very strongly built. Well, so it goes, more wars and alarms. Well, after the great success at Antipara, the Nephites were simply swamped with prisoners of war, the prisoner of war problem now, who, seeing embarrassment of their captors, began to stage prison riots. For behold, they would break out in great numbers and would fight with stones and clubs. Remember, they didn't have automatic weapons to watch them. It was a very serious problem guarding them. And they had to be bloodily suppressed. A very large body of prisoners of war was being escorted, this is an embarrassing moment, was being escorted back to the capital, back to Zarahemla, where they'd be safe, by crack Nephite troops when they collided with a Lamanite army escorting a large supply train. What would you do here? You're supporting thousands of Lamanite prisoners back to the capital, and you run into a large Lamanite supply train, which also has a large military escort. Well, it's very embarrassing. Everybody's face is red. Should we make it a pitched battle or what? Well, the guards forgot their prisoners and hightailed it back to Helaman's headquarters to report the new danger, that the Lamanites, a big force coming in there. They arrived only just in time to find the headquarters company hotly engaged with the advanced elements of the same Lamanite army and were able to join in the fighting just in time to turn the tide and save the command post. Typical. Shades of the dear old 101st. That's exactly the way things happen. Again, it was the 2,000, Helaman's 2,000 sons. You all know about them. Now augmented by 60 more boys from home who turned the tide. Well, here's another huge prisoner contingent was sent to Zarahemla, this time under the supervision of the capable Gid. En route, the Nephites got news of a Lamanite army marching on Cumene, and the city of the Nephites had just taken by blockade. Their disturbance at the news became apparent to their prisoners, who assumed that something was going badly for them and that they were in trouble, which caused them to take courage, and they did rise up in rebellion against them, rushing in a body on the Nephite sores. Most of them were slain, but the rest escaped. However, this was not an unmixed evil, for Gid was now free to hasten to the aid of Cumene, and he arrived there just in time. Well, then they dug in, and so the war dragged on, and then something went wrong. Support from the capital fell off, and the usual rumors and misgivings. You get even that part of it, the camp misgivings going on. The cause of our embarrassment, says Moroni, why they don't send us more strength, we know not. But the strange turn of things stirred up the usual cant rumors and misgivings. We were grieved and also filled with fear, he says. In this tense and gloomy situation, the army turned to prayer for comfort and found it. With morale somewhat restored, Helaman planned to take Manti by a ruse, and it would have to be a good one, since the Lamanites now knew all the answers. He did a very clever thing here, the way he takes Manti. What can you do? We've tried all the tricks in the book. No, here's one that hasn't been tried yet. He pushed his camp. With a small force, he camped just right under the walls of the city, as near as he could get. He pushed his bivouac as near to the town as he dared, by the wilderness side, where the enemy easily discovered that his force was not a very strong one. But the insolent position he had taken, which put him in a position to cut off the supplies to the city, we're told, demanded that something be done about him, even though his little army was far too weak to attempt the siege. Well, now, what could the Lamanites do? You see, we said we've been sucked in on this before. Well, we can't just let him sit there. We'll just go out and teach him a lesson. And as soon as Helaman made sure that the Lamanites were getting ready to come out and teach him a lesson, he divided his small forces into three bodies. One under Teancum went off and hid out in the wilderness in one direction, while the other under Gid moved out and lay low in the other direction. The Lamanites came out in full force and took out after Helaman, who, of course, retreated at top speed. They expected him to, leading his pursuers unawares right between the forces of Gid and Teomner, who lay quietly until they had passed and then ran into the city and fell on the guards. For in their haste and confidence, the Lamanites had left only a few to guard the town. They were easily destroyed, Moroni not being there to prevent it. The Lamanites had to give up the chase. Now, what did Helaman do then? He made straight for Zarahemla. Well, this would make his pursuers nervous. They wouldn't dare chase him, not because Zarahemla was particularly dangerous, but they expected a trap when he headed straight for the capital city. The Lamanites had to give up the chase when they found that their quarry was heading straight for Zarahemla, leading them to suspect another of those Nephite ambushes. But what they didn't suspect was that their fleeing victims would double on their tracks, march around them in the nighttime while they were sleeping, and beat them back to Manti, the last place in the world where they'd expect to find them. So the Nephites took Manti without the shedding of blood. While they bivouacked in the night, instead of going on to Zarahemla, they just returned, went around them in the night, and took Manti. Now notice how the tone of things changes. The discouraged Lamanites now began an evacuation of the area. The Nephites began cautiously and not without risk to resettle some of the lands they had retaken. Helaman permitted his 2,000 to go into a rest area at Manti. Well, that's not the difference. This is after the trouble with Pahoran then, where you get... He goes out with Pahoran. They become fast friends, you know, and they campaign together after that. And His first interest was to take Nephi, lost by his own miscalculation. There's another human touch. He had a great master plan in which he was going to take everything. So he wouldn't let anything bother him, this master plan he was building up. So the Lamanite struck first and wrecked the whole thing. And he was furious. He blamed everybody for it but himself. And, it's very interesting. Notice Moroni often lost his temper. He lost his temper in the prisoner of war letter. He wanted to exchange prisoners of war greatly to his advantage. He didn't want to appear over-eager, so he got insulting when he wrote this letter to Amoron. And Amoron insulted him back, and he lost his temper, and the result is the deal was called off. But, the same thing happened here. But then he had joined up with... got the strength he wanted after putting down the rebellion back home. The king men started up their old tricks again. It was a big coalition this time. They'd been coordinating their moves with the Lamanites. And he had to, the third time, he raised the standard of liberty against the old familiar crowd he knew so well.